Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness God called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening and there was morning, the second day.
And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together God called seas. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day.
And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night. And let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day.
And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. And God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good.
Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, they were created, male and female. God created them.
God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth and every tree with the seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food."
And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw everything that had been made, and indeed it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day.
Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that God had done and rested. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all the work done in creation. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. Amen.
There's this little soccer tournament going on. It's called the World Cup. Some of us had a hard time getting here because they had to break away from a screen to see it. And some of you probably have figured out ways to have it on your phone as you sit here right now. And some of you don't really care that much about soccer or about the World Cup. But this puts it in perspective to me. 108 million people tuned in to last year's Super Bowl. 108 million. 3.2 billion people will tune in to watch the World Cup. Whoa. 715 million, last time the World Cup was played, tuned in alone just to see the final game. Seven times more than watch the Super Bowl. That's 3.2 billion people coming together around the beautiful game. But let's be honest. We come together, yes, but it also divides us apart, right? The New York Times asked these three questions in an international survey that it conducted a few weeks ago. First, who will win the World Cup? Second, who plays the most beautiful soccer? Third, which team are you rooting against? That's every sport, right? Who are you going to root against? As much as we root for someone, we root against others. And a lot of the responses were very predictable ones. So the folks in Mexico, who do you imagine, what country would folks in Mexico most prefer to root against? Us, the United States. Russia, guess who more people in Russia will be rooting against than anyone else? The United States. In France, more people will be rooting against Algeria than anyone else. Interestingly, in the United States, more people, you have to watch the wording on this, these surveys always get confusing. More people in the United States will be rooting against the United States than against any other team. Figure that one out. Like, they're upset about Landon Donovan, correct. They're upset about Landon Donovan, so they're still not letting that go. I don't know what to do about that one. For the next 4 weeks, though, I'm confident that our attention will turn to Brazil and to the World Cup. And just as this event unites us, it will also divide us. We'll root against others and we'll be rooted against. So for many folks, when they read the story we read from Genesis, they read it as one seamless story. It's just one seamless story, Genesis 1, that we finished with, and it reads right into Genesis 2, and they think of it as it's one Bible, so we have one creation story, right? That's got to be the case. One Bible, one creation story. I want to invite you to think about this kind of like folks who watch the World Cup, and they don't root for or against anyone. These are folks who just watch the game because it's beautiful. They watch the game. I don't understand these people. They watch the game because it's beautiful. I know they exist. I'm told they exist. And the correlation to that would be reading Genesis 1 and 2 and just seeing one seamless creation story. That works for some people, but not for everyone. It certainly does not work for all. See, for many people, as they watch soccer, they watch the World Cup, they just kind of find themselves rooting for certain players or certain teams, against other players, against other teams. And I want to suggest that that's true of Genesis as well. If you spend enough time looking at those first two chapters in the Bible, I think you are inevitably going to find that this is not one story. This is two different stories. Two stories that often contradict one another. And so I think of it like this. There was two stories that were floating around in the ancient Near East. One community had this image of where we came from as a people, the one that we heard today. And it was this beautiful image of Elohim, who creates day and night. And then it continues to progress until humanity is created, and then God rests and the Sabbath. Well, if you continue reading in Genesis 2, if you're reading it in the Hebrew, you start to realize that now they're calling God by a different name. Because there was another community that had a different story about our origins, about where we came from. And their image started with Adam and Eve. They're different stories. In the first one, God creates with words, Elohim. And in the second one, God is more like a potter. She's getting her hands dirty. And out of that dirt, the dust of the ground, she's creating the world. She's creating humanity. These are different oral traditions, tribal myths that are being passed down as people try to look back at where they've come from to figure out who they are and where they're going. And when these stories started to be written down, codified, you can imagine that the people who held one story didn't find much space or room for people that held the other story, and vice versa. It's kind of like the people in Mexico are going to cheer against the United States, and the people in Russia are going to cheer against us as well. You can bet that those folks didn't come together and think, yeah, let's just include everybody's story. And there were lots of stories that were circulating in the ancient Near East. So I find it significant that the text that we hold sacred as Christian people begins with two different stories. We've always been a people of tensions. We've always held tensions or been called to, but we know that in our age today, we find loud versions of fundamentalist Christianity that want us to focus on what they believe to be a literal reading of these stories. But I want to suggest that the reality that there's two different stories sitting right next to each other, that you can't get past chapter 2, verse 5 without noticing that, would hold us to believe or have us to believe that the Bible was never intended to be read in that literal fashion. That's not what people were trying to do. They were trying to make sense of where they'd been to figure out who they were and where they were going. And so we held these two stories together simultaneously. And they function in a literary way similarly also. They both brought people together. But then there were different stories, so they also separated people. Much like the World Cup does today, we come together, and then we try to figure out which team are we rooting for or against. While those stories unite us, the story itself, especially the one that we shared this morning, it also divides us. So we find verses 27 and 28, they say this. So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, they were created. Male and female, God created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over everything that moves upon the earth. We're coming together, we're all interrelated, and yet the story also seems to be showing how we're different, dividing us up. God blesses humanity and tells it to fill the earth and have dominion over it. So, what does dominion look like? What does that mean to us? We're going to hold some of those questions this morning as we move together in this story and reflect on the World Cup. I want to know if anyone else saw John Oliver's brilliant commentary on FIFA and the World Cup. Did anybody see? A couple people saw this week. If you haven't seen it, I commend it. I think it's fabulous. He reminds us of just how complicated and how screwed up we can take this notion of dominion. Brazil built a $300 million stadium in the Amazon rainforest that will be used for four World Cup games And then no team that plays in Brazil will ever be able to fill it afterwards. $300 million on one stadium in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. Is that dominion? Could that possibly be what God's hope is for us? We hope that this worship series on the World Cup will help us to hold these tensions and to find faithful ways of responding. We're going to focus each week on a prophetic pastor or theologian and hold their writings and teachings in conversation with what's happening in the World Cup and with Scripture. We've selected these people because they've shaped who we are as followers of Jesus. So when I was in seminary, Ivana Guevara, who we're going to focus on this morning, it was her writings that actually made it possible for me to think again that I could be Christian. They helped me to claim that identity. And next week, we're going to listen to a theologian. The U.S. plays Ghana tomorrow. So next Sunday, we're going to listen to a theologian from Ghana, to her voice. And then a person from Croatia who writes about reconciliation. And then when we gather and listen to the voice of the U.S., we're going to hear from a theologian who is Native American. And then we'll close our series with a person from Germany. This morning, though, we turn to a Roman Catholic nun, Ivana Guevara. And her writings help us to think about the relationship between the earth and the entire cosmos through the perspective of her work with poor women in Brazil. So she writes this: I haven't gone out to live in the country or bought a farm, like Antonio and some of the CSA people. I haven't gone out to live in the country or bought a farm or planted a garden, like Rosemarie, or even begun to raise domestic animals. I remain an urban woman. But I now have a different perception of things, a bodily perception of the unity and the interdependence of all living things, and a growing awareness that we are one body with the whole universe. Her life among Brazilian poor women and her experience seeing how environmental degradation and poverty sit side by side, and you can't look at one, you can't look at environmentalism without looking at racism, and her unwillingness to turn her back on the people that she works with has helped her to see that we are all interrelated. God has helped her to see that. But for a lot of people, soccer helps them to see that we're all interrelated. That's especially the case in Brazil. One writer, David Zirin, writes it this: the relationship between soccer and Brazil is not so much about sports as it is about national identity. It's the connective tissue in a country defined by different cultures crashing together in violence and beauty. This nation, Brazil, is indigenous, African, German, Italian, Japanese, Lebanese, Eastern European. Brazil is a country of 200 million people, a larger area than the continental United States. It possesses the largest economy in the global south and the fifth largest in the world. This is fascinating to me. It has more people of African descent than any other country on earth outside of Nigeria. More people of Japanese descent than anywhere outside of Japan, and more Italians anywhere outside of Italy. He writes that it's the friendliest nation you could ever hope to visit, and its police have killed 10,000 people in the last decade. It is itself a place of contradiction, a place of coming together. A former Brazilian football star named Romario spoke bluntly about the violence of the World Cup in his own nation. He says, FIFA is the international organizing body of the World Cup. It's the real president of our country. FIFA comes to our country and imposes a state within a state. It's not going to pay taxes. It's going to come install a circus without paying anything and take everything with it. The money that has been spent on one stadium could have been used to build 150,000 housing units. And so we look at the rampant corruption of FIFA and the brutal ways that the World Cup allows the wealthiest in Brazil to celebrate on the backs of the poorest in Brazil. And out of that context, Ivan Guevara reminds us that the ancient problem of evil is with us today as never before. Above all, because we see an increase in the destruction of persons, of groups, and of the earth itself. She continues, our society seems ever less capable of devising formulas that permit dignified human sharing and the possibility of survival on the earth. We have the impression that our present world, despite its theories, its analysis, and its designs, turns ever more often to violence and exclusion in order to solve its problems. This, in turn, has brought about a growing wave of destruction, one greater than any time in history. Our most usual problem-solving methods have been force, weapons, brutal institutionalized violence, the murderous elimination of others, and an every-man-for-himself attitude. Returning evil for evil has become a virtual rule of life in our day. In this context, she writes, even as religions speak of God's goodness and mercy, or perhaps of the punishments of God to hell, they become ever less capable of mitigating the wave of violence that subsists and seems to grow within us. Our age-old discourse on good and evil, it no longer actually touches people's hearts. It no longer offers the satisfying explanations that it once did, and it no longer sustains us in the face of growing depravity. The benign will of God seems irrelevant to the struggle for survival and the spirit of unrestrained profiteering that's so evident in the World Cup. God just doesn't help us the way God used to, is how it feels. The rich appeal to God to protect their riches. The wretched of the earth, the hungry, the landless, the unemployed, those who thirst for justice feel ever more acutely the silence of God when hoping beyond hope. They continue to speak of God's justice. In that context, rather than pointing to the other as the source of evil, Guevara recognizes and calls us to notice the evil that is within. These are institutions, ways of being that we can't escape. They live inside of all of us, and then we recreate them out in the world as patterns of injustice. Evil is a relationship that we ourselves construct, and it leads to the unraveling of the fabric of human life. It's so evident when we look on at FIFA and at the World Cup. The 2022 World Cup is going to take place in Qatar, where average temperatures for the World Cup will be over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Most people say that the reason it's going to go there is because the people who decided received large bribes for it to go there. And John Oliver reminds us that he hopes that's actually the case, because otherwise it makes no sense to actually have this there. But the brutal reality next to that is that on average, one person building those stadiums right now is dying a day to build those World Cup stadiums for something that's that far out. And we don't have to look just to that. We can look right here at what's happening in Brazil, where the government has spent over $11 billion. And FIFA will come in, and FIFA will pay nothing to the Brazilian people, nothing to the Brazilian government. Eduardo Galeano writes, as far as I'm concerned, the explosion of indignation in Brazil is justified. In its thirst for justice, it is similar to other demonstrations that in recent years have shaken many countries in many parts of the world. Brazilians, who are the most soccer mad of all, have decided not to allow their sport to be used anymore as an excuse for humiliating the many and enriching the few. The fiesta of soccer, a feast for the legs that play and the eyes that watch, is much more than a big business run by overlords from Switzerland. The most popular sport in the world wants to serve the people who embrace it. That is a fire police violence will never put out. So what do we do? What do we do when that's the reality that takes shape around the World Cup? Do we simply turn it off? It seems that by doing so, we allow those webs of violence to just continue to be spun while we look away. So then maybe we turn it on and say, well, it's a sport. Let's just forget the other stuff that goes alongside of it. The harm that's done beyond the pitch. Let's just forget that. Let's just watch a game. It's the beautiful game. That escapism, it feels exciting to me at moments, and I'm sure I will get caught up in it more than once, probably today. But the truth is that it seems to demean and deny the interrelatedness that we encounter in Genesis and as followers of Jesus, that we can't simply look on and forget. So what if we allow the coming weeks of the World Cup to remind us of that interrelatedness, to help us wonder about how we are connected to our sisters and our brothers, just as the song we began with, how we are connected to those there in Brazil and around the world. In the coming weeks, that will be my prayer, that we don't get swept up in the World Cup and forget the nobodies who are swept away by FIFA and our collective ways of making the beautiful game anything but that. Those ways that live inside of us. See, it may be their World Cup, but it's our world, God's world. A world in which our first creation story reminds us of our interrelatedness and our interdependence. God began unfolding in the process of creation. There was poetry in that of every day. And at the end of that, it was good, very good. And God continues unfolding in the ongoing process of creation that is this day, calling us to redefine dominion, to embrace mutuality and solidarity, calling us to hope by creating relationships that are loving and just and beautiful. As a Christian, as one who seeks to follow in the ways of Jesus, that call is on my life, nothing less than that. And so I want to conclude with a reflection that Ivone Guevara uses to close her book, Longing for Running Water. It's a reflection on a song that's in our Bible called Psalm 42. It's a song of one who is in exile and longs to return to her land, to her God, and to her loves. Hear Guevara's words. Let us make this song, this lament, into our final song as exiles on our own earth, which is divided and plagued by boundaries and by prohibitions on entering and leaving. A strange song of exile sung within our own body and feeling that it barely belongs to itself. The song of one who seeks answers and knows that the few she will find are fragile and ephemeral. It is the stubborn song of one who seeks, despite everything, the beauty of the ephemeral, of that something that always escapes us, even when we insist on trying to hold it fast. It is the song of one who seeks to rediscover arms and embraces, love poems, and reasons for beginning to hope once again. It is the song that is born of the body and of the earth. As the deer longs for running waters, writes the psalmist, so we join our longing with hers, hungry and thirsty. We expect to see hope spring up once again in our own womb, in the womb of the earth, out of our entrails, out of the divine that lives within us and renews us. Like the deer, we move forward seeking that what will bring us to life, what will enliven our sacred body with its 1,001 lives. Like the deer, We've sensed those living waters from afar, and now we run toward them, but with no certitudes, barely allowing our goal to keep us alive, to keep us dreaming, and to prepare for us the next step on the way. As the deer longs for running water, we live in thankfulness for those who carry within them the fragile stubbornness of seeking, of ceaseless searching. My body is thirsty for this water, for the water of life, the life of water. When will we go to drink it and to tremble with joy with the multitude of the poor, with the trees and flowers, with the fishes and birds, with the stars and the moon, with the rain and the wind, with the snow and the dew, with the sun and with the entire earth, as the deer longs for running waters? May we come to this table with fragile stubbornness of seeking, of ceaseless searching. May our thirst and our hunger be met as we gather here at God's table. Amen.